This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Daniel Deronda by George Eliot. Chapter 40. Within the soul a faculty abides that with interpositions which would hide and darken, so can deal, that they become contingencies of pomp, and serve to exalt her native brightness as the ample moon, in the deep stillness of a summer even, rising behind a thick and lofty grove, into a substance glorious as her own, yea, with her own incorporated, by power capacious and serene. Wordsworth, Excursion, Book 4. Deronda came out of the narrow house at Chelsea in a frame of mind that made him long for some good bodily exercise to carry off what he was himself inclined to call the fumes of his temper. He was going toward the city, and the sight of the Chelsea stairs with the waiting boats at once determined him to avoid the irritating inaction of being driven in a cab by calling a wherry and taking an oar. His errand was to go to Ram's bookshop, where he had yesterday arrived too late for Mordecai's midday watch, and had been told that he invariably came there again between 5 and 6. Some further acquaintance with this remarkable inmate of the Cohens was particularly desired by Deronda as a preliminary to redeeming his ring. He wished that their conversation should not again end speedily with that drop of Mordecai's interest which was like the removal of a drawbridge, and threatened to shut out any easy communication in future. As he got warmed with the use of the oar, fixing his mind on the errand before him and the ends he wanted to achieve on Mirah's account, he experienced, as was wont with him, a quick change of mental light, shifting his point of view to that of the person whom he had been thinking of hitherto chiefly as serviceable to his own purposes, and was inclined to taunt himself with being not much better than an enlisting sergeant who never troubles himself with the drama that brings him the needful recruits. "I suppose if I got from this man the information I am most anxious about," thought Deronda, "I should be contented enough if he felt no disposition to tell me more of himself, or why he seemed to have some expectation from me which was disappointed. The sort of curiosity he stirs would die out, and yet it might be that he had neared and parted as one can imagine two ships doing, each freighted with an exile who would have recognized the other if the two could have looked out face to face. Not that there is any likelihood of a peculiar tie between me and this poor fellow, whose voyage I fancy must soon be over. But I wonder whether there is much of that momentous mutual missing between people who interchange blank looks, or even long for one another's absence in a crowded place. However, one makes oneself chances of missing by going on the recruiting sergeant's plan." When the wherry was approaching Blackfriars Bridge, where Deronda meant to land, it was 4:30, and the gray day was dying gloriously, its western clouds all broken into narrowing purple strata before a wide-spreading saffron clearness, which in the sky had a monumental calm, but on the river, with its changing objects, was reflected as a luminous movement, the alternate flash of ripples or currents, the sudden glow of the brown sail, the passage of laden barges from blackness into color, making an active response to that brooding glory. Feeling well heated by this time, Deronda gave up the oar and drew over him again his Inverness cape. As he lifted up his head while fastening the topmost button, his eyes caught a well-remembered face looking toward him over the parapet of the bridge, brought out by the western light into startling distinctness and brilliancy, an illuminated type of bodily emaciation and spiritual eagerness. It was the face of Mordecai, who also, in his watch toward the west, had caught sight of the advancing boat, and had kept it fast within his gaze, at first simply because it was advancing, then with a recovery of impressions that made him quiver as with a presentiment, till at last the nearing figure lifted up its face toward him, the face of his visions, and then immediately, with white uplifted hand, beckoned again and again. For Deronda, anxious that Mordecai should recognize and await him, had lost no time before signaling, and the answer came straightway. Mordecai lifted his cap and waved it, feeling in that moment that his inward prophecy was fulfilled. Obstacles, incongruities, all melted into the sense of completion with which his soul was flooded by this outward satisfaction of his longing. His exultation was not widely different from that of the experimenter, bending over the first stirrings of change that correspond to what in the fervor of concentrated prevision his thought has foreshadowed. The prefigured friend had come from the golden background and had signaled to him. This actually was. The rest was to be. In 3 minutes Deronda had landed, had paid his boatman, and was joining Mordecai, whose instinct it was to stand perfectly still and wait for him. "I was very glad to see you standing here," said Deronda, "for I was intending to go on to the bookshop and look for you again. I was there yesterday. Perhaps they mentioned it to you?" "Yes," said Mordecai. "That was the reason I came to the bridge." This answer, made with simple gravity, was startlingly mysterious to Deronda. Were the peculiarities of this man really associated with any sort of mental alienation, according to Cohen's hint? "You knew nothing of my being at Chelsea," he said, after a moment. "No, but I expected you to come down the river. I have been waiting for you these 5 years." Mordecai's deep-sunk eyes were fixed on those of the friend who had at last arrived with a look of affectionate dependence, at once pathetic and solemn. Deronda's sensitiveness was not the less responsive because he could not but believe that this strangely disclosed relation was founded on an illusion. "It will be a satisfaction to me if I can be of any real use to you," he answered very earnestly. "Shall we get into a cab and drive to wherever you wish to go? You have probably had walking enough with your short breath." "Let us go to the bookshop. It will soon be time for me to be there. But now look up the river," said Mordecai, turning again toward it and speaking in undertones of what may be called an excited calm, so absorbed by a sense of fulfillment that he was conscious of no barrier to a complete understanding between him and Deronda. "See the sky, how it is slowly fading. I have always loved this bridge. I stood on it when I was a little boy. It is a meeting place for the spiritual messengers. It is true what the masters said, that each order of things has its angel. That means the full message of each from what is afar. Here I have listened to the messages of earth and sky. When I was stronger, I used to stay and watch for the stars in the deep heavens. But this time, just about sunset, was always what I loved best. It has sunk into me and dwelt with me, fading, slowly fading. It was my own decline. It paused. It waited. Till at last it brought me my new life, my new self, who will live when this breath is all breathed out." Deronda did not speak. He felt himself strangely wrought upon. The first prompted suspicion that Mordecai might be liable to hallucinations of thought, might have become a monomaniac on some subject which had given too severe a strain to his diseased organism, gave way to a more submissive expectancy. His nature was too large, too ready to conceive regions beyond his own experience, to rest at once in the easy explanation, madness, whenever a consciousness showed some fullness and conviction where his own was blank. It accorded with his habitual disposition that he should meet rather than resist any claim on him in the shape of another's need, and this claim brought with it a sense of solemnity which seemed a radiation from Mordecai, as utterly nullifying his outward poverty and lifting him into an authority, as if he had been that preternatural guide seen in the universal legend, who suddenly drops his mean disguise and stands a manifest power. That impression was the more sanctioned by a sort of resolved quietude which the persuasion of fulfillment had produced in Mordecai's manner. After they had stood a moment in silence, he said, "Let us go now." And when they were riding, he added, "We will get down at the end of the street and walk to the shop. You can look at the books, and Mr. Ram will be going away directly and leave us alone." It seemed that this enthusiast was just as cautious, just as much alive to judgments in other minds as if he had been that antipode of all enthusiasm called a man of the world. While they were rattling along in the cab, Mirah was still present with Deronda in the midst of this strange experience, but he foresaw that the course of conversation would be determined by Mordecai, not by himself. He was no longer confident what questions he should be able to ask, and with a reaction on his own mood he inwardly said, "I suppose I am in a state of complete superstition, just as if I were awaiting the destiny that could interpret the oracle. But some strong relation there must be between me and this man, since he feels it strongly. Great heaven! What relation has proved itself more potent in the world than faith even when mistaken, than expectation even when perpetually disappointed? Is my side of the relation to be disappointing or fulfilling? Well, if it is ever possible for me to fulfill, I will not disappoint." In 10 minutes the two men, with as intense a consciousness as if they had been two undeclared lovers, felt themselves alone in the small gas-lit bookshop and turned face to face, each baring his head from an instinctive feeling that they wished to see each other fully. Mordecai came forward to lean his back against the little counter, while Deronda stood against the opposite wall hardly more than 4 feet off. "I wish I could perpetuate those two faces, as Titian's tribute money has perpetuated two types presenting another sort of contrast. Imagine, we all of us can, the pathetic stamp of consumption with its brilliancy of glance to which the sharply defined structure of features reminding one of a forsaken temple give already a far-off look as of one getting unwillingly out of reach. And imagine it on a Jewish face, naturally accentuated for the expression of an eager mind, the face of a man little above 30, but with that age upon it which belongs to time lengthened by suffering, the hair and beard still black, throwing out the yellow pallor of the skin, the difficult breathing giving more decided marking to the mobile nostril, the wasted yellow hands conspicuous on the folded arms. Then give to the yearning consumptive glance something of the slowly dying mother's look when her one loved son visits her bedside, and the flickering power of gladness leaps out as she says, "My boy!" For the sense of spiritual perpetuation in another resembles that maternal transference of self. Seeing such a portrait, you would see Mordecai, and opposite to him was a face not more distinctly oriental than many a type seen among what we call the Latin races, rich in youthful health and with a forcible masculine gravity in its repose that gave the value of judgment to the reverence with which he met the gaze of this mysterious son of poverty who claimed him as a long-expected friend. The more exquisite quality of Deronda's nature, that keenly perceptive sympathetic emotiveness which ran along with his speculative tendency, was never more thoroughly tested. He felt nothing that could be called belief in the validity of Mordecai's impressions concerning him, or in the probability of any greatly effective issue. What he felt was a profound sensibility to a cry from the depths of another, and accompanying that, the summons to be receptive instead of superciliously prejudging. Receptiveness is a rare and massive power, like fortitude, and this state of mind now gave Deronda's face its utmost expression of calm, benignant force, an expression which nourished Mordecai's confidence and made an open way before him. He began to speak. "You cannot know what has guided me to you and brought us together at this moment. You are wondering." "I am not impatient," said Deronda. "I am ready to listen to whatever you may wish to disclose." "You see some of the reasons why I needed you," said Mordecai, speaking quietly, as if he wished to reserve his strength. "You see that I am dying. You see that I am as one shut up behind bars by the wayside, who, if he spoke to any, would be met only by head-shaking and pity. The day is closing. The light is fading. Soon we should not have been able to discern each other. But you have come in time." "I rejoice that I am come in time," said Deronda feelingly. He would not say, "I hope you are not mistaken in me." The very word mistaken, he thought, would be a cruelty at that moment. "But the hidden reasons why I need you began afar off," said Mordecai. "Began in my early years when I was studying in another land. Then ideas, beloved ideas, came to me because I was a Jew. They were a trust to fulfill because I was a Jew. They were an inspiration because I was a Jew and felt the heart of my race beating within me. They were my life. I was not fully born till then. I counted this heart, this breath, and this right hand." Mordecai had pathetically pressed his hand upon his breast, and then stretched its wasted fingers out before him. "I counted my sleep and my waking, and the work I fed my body with, and the sights that fed my eyes. I counted them but as a fuel to the divine flame. But I had done as one who wanders and engraves his thought in rocky solitudes, and before I could change my course came care and labor and disease, and blocked the way before me, and bound me with the iron that eats itself into the soul. Then I said, 'How shall I save the life within me from being stifled with this stifled breath?'" Mordecai paused to rest that poor breath which had been taxed by the rising excitement of his speech. And also he wished to check that excitement. Deronda dared not speak. The very silence in the narrow space seemed alive with mingled awe and compassion before this struggling fervor. And presently Mordecai went on. "But you may misunderstand me. I speak not as an ignorant dreamer, as one bred up in the inland valleys, thinking ancient thoughts anew and not knowing them ancient, never having stood by the great waters where the world's knowledge passes to and fro. English is my mother tongue. England is the native land of this body, which is but as a breaking pot of earth around the fruit-bearing tree, whose seed might make the desert rejoice. But my true life was nourished in Holland at the feet of my mother's brother, a rabbi skilled in special learning. And when he died, I went to Hamburg to study, and afterwards to Göttingen, that I might take a larger outlook on my people and on the Gentile world, and drank knowledge at all sources. I was a youth. I felt free. I saw our chief seats in Germany. I was not then in utter poverty, and I had possessed myself of a handicraft. For I said, 'I care not if my lot be as that of Joshua ben Cananja. After the last destruction he earned his bread by making needles, but in his youth he had been a singer on the steps of the temple and had a memory of what was before the glory departed. I said, let my body dwell in poverty, and my hands be as the hands of the toiler. But let my soul be as a temple of remembrance where the treasures of knowledge enter and the inner sanctuary is hope. I knew what I chose. They said, he feeds himself on visions, and I denied not, for visions are the creators and feeders of the world. I see, I measure the world as it is, which the vision will create anew. You are not listening to one who raves aloof from the lives of his fellows.'" Mordecai paused, and Deronda, feeling that the pause was expectant, said, "Do me the justice to believe that I was not inclined to call your words raving. I listen that I may know, without prejudgment. I have had experience which gives me a keen interest in the story of a spiritual destiny embraced willingly and embraced in youth." "A spiritual destiny embraced willingly in youth," Mordecai repeated in a corrective tone. "It was the soul fully born within me, and it came in my boyhood. It brought its own world, a medieval world, where there are men who made the ancient language live again, a new psalms of exile. They had absorbed the philosophy of the Gentile into the faith of the Jew, and they still yearned toward a center for our race. One of their souls was born again within me and awakened amid the memories of their world. It traveled into Spain and Provence. It debated with Eben Ezra. It took ship with Jehuda HaLevi. It heard the roar of the Crusaders and the shrieks of tortured Israel. And when its dumb tongue was loosed, it spoke the speech they had made alive with the new blood of their ardor, their sorrow, their martyred trust. It sang with the cadence of their strain.